Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, in just a minute, I'm going to have you say hello, but I also want you to open us in prayer. We've already got Dr. Edwin Vieira, I believe, is online with a live mic, and also we've got Colorado State Senator Kent Lambert that's with us, and it's going to be a great show tonight. I'm really looking forward to it. Red, would you open us, please?
Yes. Hello, everybody, and I think having God's blessing on this would be the thing to do. Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the talents and the type of people that we have been able to get on these programs and the value that they have to offer to our country. We thank You for them, and we just thank You for our special guest tonight, because he has a tremendous amount of background and such, and we are so fortunate, and we just thank You for making it available. We thank You for Your many, many blessings. We have had a lot of blessings come by way of these programs, and I have every reason to believe that they will continue. And we hope and pray that they will. And we just pray now that You would give us the words to speak. And we would pray that we have the audience that needs to hear the message tonight. And so we just thank You for everything and welcome you to listen in on the program with a lot of others. And we just ask this now in Thy precious name. Amen.
Well, amen. I'm going to introduce three different people right now. We've got Dr. Edwin Vieira on with us, who is our main guest tonight, but we've also got with us Colorado State Senator Kent Lambert that has a live mic, Edwin, and will be able to join this conversation as he sees fit and wants to ask questions as we talk about sound money, and also I'd like to get a little bit into state banks when we get there. And a little bit later in the show, we've got also Stephen Hance that's on with us. And I know he's going to want to talk a little bit about border reviews in the last hour of the show. So, Edwin, how about we give us the listeners a little, just a tiny bit of background. I believe most everybody's familiar with your, you're well known here. You've been a guest at Walls in Our Minds often in the past, and we have I have to tell you, I think you're probably my number one favorite guest to have on the show, and we really appreciate your research and your ability and the writings that you've done and all of the work that you've done, especially in writing some of the sound money, proposed sound money legislation. We're just really pleased and proud to have you here with us on Walls in Our Minds.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, you want to tell people a little bit about what you're doing lately here, maybe some of the books that you've been working on. I know you've got one that's at the publisher and another one you're ready to do, and maybe let them know that your wife has cleaned up your act and so you're not going to be producing in totally encyclopedic work so the common guy can pick something up and read it here.
Well, I think the common guy can read encyclopedic works. I don't expect someone to sit down and read a 2,000-page book at one sitting, but you don't do that with the Encyclopedia Britannica either. You delve into this subject or that subject. The last book that I produced on the militia is called The Sword and Sovereignty, It's actually a CD because it was a little bit too expensive at this stage to put out as a printed book. That's available on Amazon. All these books are going to be available on Amazon. That one is encyclopedic in the sense that it goes through history and analysis of the pre-constitutional colonial and state militia, which essentially is the only way that you can derive the real meaning of the term well-regulated militia, militia of the several states, and related terms in the U.S. Constitution, because they're not defined, of course, in that document. And the value of that book, I think, for people who have essentially no background in this, is precisely that it is encyclopedic. In fact, what I tell folks, if you simply read the table of contents, about 30 pages, most of which is white space, you'll end up knowing more than 99% of the people in the entire world, because each one of the chapters has a little descriptive heading in the table of contents, and the descriptive heading pretty much lays out in outline all of the material and argument that's found in the book. One of the reasons that book is picked as long as it is, 2,304 pages, is because of the vast number of footnotes and endnotes that take people to the original sources. Oftentimes when I talk about the militia, I get this look of disbelief. That couldn't be right type of attitude. And I say, well, don't believe me. Go look it up yourself. I tell you exactly where to find it in terms of, in some instances, where you can actually get the books or the CDs that have a lot of this material. The most recent book that I'm working on now is called 13 Words. It's a short book. It's about 110 pages long. And it deals with what I consider to be the most important 13 words in the Constitution. We may get to that later. And then I have another book I'm just finishing up now. 13 Words probably out in a couple of weeks. It's the printers now. The latest book is called Three Rights, which takes those 13 words and extrapolates into three fundamental rights that are necessary to understand in order to enforce the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Then I have a book that will follow up later. It'll probably be out by the end of the summer for sure, called The Bastardy of Martial Law. Because martial law is really the contradiction of everything in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, at least martial law as you hear people talking about it today. And this particular book goes into that in what I would consider to be great detail and exposes all of the anti-constitutional fallacies in what's being put forward in the public domain now about what martial law is and the authority of the government to impose martial law and so forth and so on. So that's what's out there now, and otherwise what I'm trying to do is to make some inroads with state legislators here and there, wherever they're sympathetic to some of these ideas, especially in the area of alternative currencies, getting back to the monetary issue, because that's obviously a problem that's very much with us today. And at least to determine whether in some state legislature we can get a bill passed that sets up some kind of study commission or committee that will investigate the effects of the breakdown of the monetary and banking system in this country on that particular state or states in general, and then propose some alternatives that the state could adopt, and in particular an alternative currency that would come into play when, I don't say if, when the Federal Reserve finally goes into meltdown. That's a fairly difficult thing to do because there's a tremendous amount of resistance, I'm sure you're aware of this, in the state legislatures, to dealing with the monetary issue. I mean, they all tend to shy away from the militia issue simply because they're afraid of that word. It's been demonized so much in the mass media. Organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and so forth have made the word militia essentially a four-letter word. But money is almost as difficult to get a hearing. So over the last few years, we've been trying in Virginia, because, of course, I live in Virginia. I know a number of Virginia legislators, to have a bill along those lines passed. And it's primarily an investigatory bill. It doesn't provide for a specific remedy or even a specific direction that the legislature might take. The idea is to put the problem on the table, bring in a number of expert witnesses, and if the bankers want to bring in their witnesses, that's fine too. But have that kind of evidence and testimony presented, and then some kind of remedial legislation, one would hope, would be proposed, and at least the debate can move one step further along. But it's a very, very uphill battle, Terry.
Well, we know that because we've seen, you know, how many of these have died in committee because along party lines, because we did not have that grassroots support built prior to submitting those bills. And I can tell you, like I said, one of your co-sponsors here in Colorado, Senator Kent Lambert, is online with us, and he's watched what's happened with the bills that he's sponsored here, and we don't want to make that mistake again. We want to make sure that we get a good early start on it and get good education at the grassroots level, and bring some petition support so that we can lay it on our worst enemies' desk and let them know that they're going to be put out of office. We've got two recalls actively working here right now for state senators, and I think this is setting a precedence, and we're trying to send a shot across the bow, if you will, that if you want to not listen to your constituents and not represent people, we're not going to continue to tolerate it the way it's been tolerated in the past. So you and the senator can have some conversation about that. Senator, would you like to chime in a little bit at this point about what you see as being a requirement for getting at least these sound money bills to the floor for a vote?
Well, I think you're correct that in Colorado we have both the House and the Senate and the governorship controlled by Democrats and have very little opportunity to get bills through. However, we're not waiting for that. We've, in Colorado, formed an organization called the Republican Study Committee of Colorado that's sort of loosely along the lines of the Republican Study Committee in the House of Representatives in the U.S. Congress, and we're using that organization to hold meetings and hold hearings. We've had several meetings about not specifically monetary policy, but fiscal policy in general, which includes monetary policy. We've had experts coming from academia, and we sure love to have Edwin out sometime in Colorado. If you can come out and visit, we'd love to sponsor something for him as well. But we have had some successes. We did have a bill that had to do with economic policy. It actually passed the Senate on a party-line vote, so I was rather proud that at least all of my Republican colleagues were voting in favor of that, and it just shows that people are listening. We don't have the votes right yet to get some of these passed, but in the future, the pendulum swings both ways, and it very well could be in the next couple of years that we'll have the majority control back in the legislature and perhaps in the governorship as well, and those things will, come to the top.
Well, Senator, perhaps you could fill me in on something that has always seemed to me to be very strange. This monetary and banking problem is analogous to the Titanic in a sense. We're all on this ship together, and it's fairly obvious that we have a major problem. Anyone who looks at it in great detail says, well, this is going to sink at some point in the future. It's not a question of if, it's simply a question of when. So it's not really a matter of ideology. It's not really a matter of party label. It's a matter of dealing with a crisis which, if we don't deal with it, may be horrendous. As I say to people all the time, what do you think the consequences will be in a market economy, a highly complicated market economy in a huge country such as this, if the banking and monetary system goes into meltdown and we lose the currency unit? Go, for instance, into a hyperinflationary event such as the Weimar Republic in 1923 in Germany. And you can certainly imagine also the worst of all possible worlds, which would be an economic depression coupled with a hyperinflationary event. There's absolutely no reason those two things can't happen at the same time. Once the monetary unit collapses, the price structure collapses with it. And that means that production, transportation, distribution, consumption all become chaotic, because in a market economy, prices drive the use of all forms of resources, both at the production level and the consumption level. And it is, if you talk to most economists, at least the ones that I've talked to here in Virginia, they say, well, that would be unprecedented. We don't know what would come out of a complete collapse of a monetary unit in a society as complicated as this one. You can't simply go back to barter overnight. I mean, it's not going to be like World War II Germany in the occupation, when cigarettes and nylons were being used as a kind of ersatz currency for a while in the black markets. A barter in a society such as this is simply too complicated, because there are so many thousands and thousands of products and services that you want to maintain, or you would hope you would maintain. So one would think that in a Titanic situation, you would start to look at the lifeboats and make some kind of count as to how many people can get into these lifeboats. And the reality is now, unlike the Titanic, we have no lifeboat with respect to this crisis. There is nothing in work in terms of dealing with a currency collapse. Unfortunately, I mean, it was unfortunate for the people on the Titanic. They couldn't build any more lifeboats. We can. It certainly is conceivable that we can set up some alternative currency structures starting at the state level, because I'm pretty sure Congress is not going to take this in hand. And so I just sort of sit back and shrug my shoulders, shake my head, and say, what kind of irresponsibility is there in these state legislatures? I don't care whether they're Republicans or Democrats or independents or socialists or Nazis, for that matter. It doesn't make any difference what that party label is. Looking at this kind of a problem and refusing to try to deal with it, it escapes me.
Well, I totally agree with you, Edwin, that I shouldn't say Dr. Vieira. We haven't met personally, but, you know, I think we have already had the warning shots in this meltdown. You know, I did some engineering. I was graduated of the Air Force Academy, and one of the experiments we did, I remember, in mechanics was putting stress on a piece of metal. And you stress it, and it comes to a point of plasticity, and it'll stretch out. But at a certain point, it will simply fail. The metal will break. And, you know, I think we've already had two major stresses on the economy that we should have been watching, probably 1998. And I might mention I heard this, a very good explanation of this from James Rickards, the author of Currency Wars, just this week. And he said, you know, back in 1998, things started to deform so much that we, you know, the mandarins of the economy got together and they said, well, you know, how far can we stretch this? How far can we leverage the banks, and what's going to be safe? And they made some serious mistakes. They looked at their econometric models, and they, you know, came up with a solution, and they forgot something called a derivative. And it completely distorted the predictability that they were working towards at that time. The same thing happened then again 10 years later in 2008. We started distorting the markets until, you know, a minor breaking point there. It started stretching out, and then people reacted to that. If this happens again, I don't think we're at a point of plasticity. I think we're at a point of rupture. And as you said, where do you go? We may very well have to go to some sort of pseudo barter economy, or you know, somebody mentioned these little flasks of liquor that you get on the airliners, or, you know, in a hotel room or something. Something, anything that's physical, that's going to maintain its value, because the currency system may just not be there. And this is a worldwide issue now. I'm looking around. I can't see anything but a fiat currency anywhere in the world at this point. And the entire price system has been so distorted that, you know, if this does start to slip, how do you put a price on anything except for tangibles?
Well, that's exactly the problem. And if you can't put rational prices on production of goods and services, then, of course, the entire market breaks down. This is the problem of what they call rational economic calculations, the reason the Soviet mm-hmm. Union collapsed. It wasn't because of the Solidarity labor union in Poland. It wasn't because of the Pope. It wasn't because of Star Wars. It was because they had this non-rational system. And they got along for a fairly good length of time by importing, as it were, prices from the world's free markets and using those as guidelines. But within their system, that was insufficient because of the central direction of this, and of course they had a tremendous amount of corruption and so forth and so on. They couldn't maintain a rational allocation of resources. Well, if that happens in this country, the standard of living is going to drop to third world levels. And you can imagine the level of social dislocation, civil unrest, civil disobedience that will occur under those circumstances. And how are you going to put a lid on that? Not to mention the fact you bring up James Rickards, because Currency Wars, that book, is about the potential for international currency wars, which eventually lead to trade wars, and maybe eventually is not a long period of time either, and then perhaps, as has happened in the past, to real wars. So the potential for disaster here on many levels is very, very high. And all I would say about the people in Washington is they're totally dysfunctional. They've proven that. Their incompetence is incredible. Now, the question is, are we going to sit back here and let these people continue to steer the Titanic? It's really as simple as that. Because if we do, we're going down. And we may go down big time, especially if the crisis rises to an international level with hostility between us on the one side and the Chinese and the Russians, the BRIC nations and so forth and so on the other. There's no predicting how bad that may become, that situation may become.
Well, I agree. At least in his book title, David Stockman talked about the corruption of capitalism in America when he was talking about the great deformation. Well, you know, we are deformed. Our price structures are deformed. And the most important thing is the corruption that we have in America. And you're correct. We have, and I'm sorry to say, members of my party who will vote for pork barrel influence in their own districts, despite the overall negatives that those, multiply on the economy as a whole. I personally think we see a lot, more of that probably in the Democrat Party, but Republicans are not immune to that. And I don't know if it's just they don't understand what's really happening here, because I know the people, generally the people of the United States, certainly do not understand, and they're getting less and less prepared for the tsunami that is bound to come. Like you say, if we actually go into a spiral down depression again, we have more and more people that are dependent upon the government. They're going to be looking to government solutions, perhaps government force, to solve their immediate problems, and that opens itself up to more and more tyranny. They are not prepared for any kind of autonomous action to survive the wake of the Titanic that you said. If it's going down and we've done is to, move the deck chairs around, woe to us all.
And what's really unfortunate about this is we have a federal system of government that is designed to deal with these kinds of problems and check and balance methodology. I mean, if there's some kind of gridlock in Congress, the states have constitutional authority to take certain kinds of action. But we don't see any movement at the state level. So you even see, as the Declaration of Independence calls it, the form of government here. is breaking down, or at least it's not functioning. It's gone into some kind of stasis, because what one would expect in the check and balance mechanism, well, if there's some kind of failure at the congressional level, there'll be some action taken at the states or vice versa. But we see nothing but failure and irresponsibility at every level. And the average American, well, you know, we hear how people are dumbed down in the schools and so forth and so on. I'm, you know, willing to accept that. But at some stage, the average American has an understanding of the concept of insurance, right? Most people have automobiles and they're insured. Many people who have homes, of course, they're insured. People have life insurance. People have health insurance. They understand that there are risks in the world for which you have to pay some kind of a premium ongoing in order to minimize the effects of some catastrophic situation. And that's what an alternative currency structure at the state level would be, essentially. If these people in Washington, Federal Reserve, people in New York City who are really pulling the strings of the Federal Reserve, if they can somehow get this monetary and banking system under control, then we wouldn't have to use the alternative currency mechanism. It would be the same as my insurance policy on my cars that I've never used because I've never hit anyone. But I have that hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of insurance in case I run over the little blind girl in the wheelchair in the crosswalk someday, right? And the danger of, or the likelihood of that happening to me, I believe, is far less than the likelihood of one of these economic catastrophic situations happening to this country, certainly in my lifetime, and I would say probably in the next at least 10 years, inside of 10 years. Now, if you go and look at a website by a fellow by the name of Lawrence Kotlikoff, he's a Boston University economics professor. And I would call him kind of middle-of-the-road economist, establishment economist. He's done some econometric studies over the years, and the last one that I saw on his website, he says the real debt of the government in Washington, if you include all of the contingent liabilities and what he calls the fiscal gap, which is the projected shortfall of revenues in comparison to expenditures, it's not $16 trillion, it's not $20 trillion, it's $240-some trillion. Well, that's unpayable on the face of it. It's an impossible situation. And yet, knowing those figures are notorious. This fellow's been talking and making those calculations and talking about this since he first published a paper, I think it was in 2006, in the bulletin of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, for heaven's sakes. It was a Federal Reserve publication. And the numbers then were of the order of $70 trillion. Now they're over $220, $230 trillion. So the danger here is something that's right in front of our faces. And it would seem to me that anyone with the least amount of foresight and responsibility would say, yes, we need to set up some kind of a system that will provide us with insurance against the potential catastrophe. And the beauty of doing it at the state level is you can set these systems up. They're mostly off-the-shelf technology. And you wouldn't necessarily have to use them. They would simply be there, ready to go. People would have the ability to use them if a crisis occurred. But you have to have that system set up before the crisis. If I hit the little blind girl in the wheelchair when my insurance has expired, my insurance doesn't pay, right? I have to continue to maintain the payment of those premiums in order to be covered. So this is the problem we're seeing. Here's the danger. It should be apparent to anyone who has an IQ higher than the wattage on a light bulb. And yet no action is being taken. When no one would conduct his normal personal affairs on the same basis. Who drives a car without insurance? Who lives in a home without insurance? Who goes without some kind of personal insurance if he can afford it? Essentially no one I've ever run into. And yet on the national level and the state level, we're doing the exact opposite collectively of what any prudent individual would do individually. And that has to stop, or the situation is going to stop us.
Your analogy to insurance is I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's okay. No, I agree. His analogy of insurance is right on. I want to let Representative John Heichel in New Hampshire know he raised his hand, and I have given him a live mic, and I just want him to be aware that he's got a live mic. I want to come back to you and make sure you get your question in, Representative Heichel, in just a short time. I want to first, Edwin, back you up a little bit. You started into talking about, off-the-shelf kind of how easy this might be to set up in a state, but we've got a lot of listeners here tonight. We've got a large crowd, and I know that some of them would very much like to hear at the beginning of this conversation, which we're already a half hour into, some of the basics about the sound money system within a state and why it needs to be at a state level. You've watched me. I've used you as a mentor for a number of years, and I've been out there trying to convince people in the freedom community, the freedom fighters, if you will, the libertarian and conservative-minded people out there that want to restore this republic. When I start talking about sound money, they immediately start talking about things like local currencies, Ithaca hours. Why do you need gold and silver since the international banksters, the ones that Alfred Lawson called the alien financiers, control all the metal markets? There's not enough metal. You hear all of this kind of stuff, and I'd like, Edwin, for you to kind of take us back to the basics for just a minute and talk about this state system and give the people the basics of it and why it will work and why you've set it up in the way that you have based on your research.
Well, the first consideration is the legalities of this thing and the abilities of the states to do it without interference from Washington. Because we can expect interference coming from Washington. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, Clause 1, says, "No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts." Now, that is an explicitly reserved authority. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. You don't even have to depend upon the 10th Amendment. It's right there in the original Constitution. And as a reserved power of the states within the original Constitution, it is an exception to all of the powers of Congress. Congress cannot use the taxing power, the commerce power, its own money power, to override or interfere with the exercise of that reserved power of the states because the Constitution has set it up that way. So we start off with the ability legally of the states to do this. And in fact, the Supreme Court on two occasions in the 1800s was faced with this question: could the states opt out of the use of a currency that Congress had created, the Lincoln greenbacks of the Civil War? And the first one was Lane County versus Oregon. And that was a situation in which the state of Oregon required its taxes to be paid in gold and silver coin. And a sheriff collected taxes in Lincoln greenbacks because they had been declared to be legal tender for all debts pursuant to a congressional statute. And the sheriff was sued on his bond because he hadn't collected gold and silver coins, and he tried to defend himself on the basis of, well, Congress has made this paper currency legal tender, and therefore I can accept this, the taxpayer can pay it. Case goes to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, wrong. The states are quasi-sovereign entities. They've given up some of their sovereignty through the Constitution. Some powers have been delegated to Congress. But in other respects, they are complete governments, and this is one of them, the power to tax. The essential governmental functions that require the uses of money are within the control of the state. The state can determine what the currency shall be that it is going to use for those purposes. So if you think of the basic functions of government, taxation, borrowing, spending, payments in eminent domain, collection of fines and other costs through the courts, right? The basic functions of government. All of those would fall into this determination the Supreme Court made on two separate occasions. So there's no question the states have that power. But it is, of course, limited to gold and silver coin. Now, you have decisions of the Supreme Court that talk about the difference between coin and bullion, which is really merely a technical difference, that coins have been stamped and certified through that stamp by the government as containing a certain weight and purity of a particular metal. and bullion typically is not done that way. But you could run a bullion system in that way, have a kind of state certification of the purity and weight of a particular bar. And so there's no question that you'd fall into some decisions of the Supreme Court that said there was really no difference constitutionally between the two of them. Now, to flip over to the economic side, people say, well, there's not enough gold and silver in the world. And my response is, at what price? The market's always clear. At what price? And if we're talking about the collapse of the present Federal Reserve system, when that happens, there will no longer be a gold or a silver price in Federal Reserve notes. Things and services will have gold prices and silver prices. There will be no Federal Reserve price, just as there is no Weimar Mark price for goods and services in Germany, just as there is no Confederate dollar price for goods and services in Georgia. All right? When a currency collapses, it disappears from the market. End of discussion. Right? And that's probably what's going to happen. Now, in terms of the technology here, what we're really talking about is first some sort of depository system, and that needs to be controlled by the state, so you can't have a Bernard von Nothaus situation where the Treasury Department comes in and the Justice Department comes in and seizes the gold and silver because it belongs to some private party. It's controlled entirely by the state, and therefore it's subject to the reserved power and authority of the state under the Constitution. And then the state wants to be able to transfer ownership interests in this gold. So you set up a system, and these systems are already out there. They've been tried and proven in the marketplace. Each individual, organization, corporation, state entity, whatever, owns some amount of the gold and the silver in that depository. And then that is exchanged electronically, because you don't want people actually physically moving the gold back and forth. It's exchanged electronically through a system which uses a weight of gold and a weight of silver as the two units. And the beauty of this electronic system is that you can cut down the unit to extremely small sizes. A thousandth of a gram, a ten-thousandth of a gram. Well, now you're making small change in gold. So the problem of the coinage systems in the past, which was there were coins only of a certain size, and therefore it was difficult sometimes to make change or make small transactions that didn't fall within one or the other of the coinage sizes that were out there. And, of course, that led to token coinage, and it led to paper currency and bank account currency and all the problems that then derived from that. The system now is technologically capable of perfecting gold and silver transactions. Whole thing is done electronically. You can keep records in not only the gold and silver amount weights that go out, but if there are other currencies that people would be dealing with, the computers would spit out the value of that transaction in yen or yuan or rubles or whatever it would be for potential international transactions. So the technology is there. The average person would deal with this very simply. He'd be issued a debit card from the state depository. And then he would be told, here's how you can transfer funds out of the Federal Reserve System now, out of the banks of the Federal Reserve System, into our gold and silver depository. You give us the order, we'll go into the gold markets, the silver markets, and we'll make this exchange and credit you with a certain amount of gold, which you, in fact, will own. This isn't a fractional reserve system. Each individual owns some part of that gold in the depository. And then you use your debit card in the same way you use a debit card today, all electronic transactions. And then we take one step further. We go to the businessmen in the state, corporations, individuals. We say, within 60 or 90 days of the passage of this statute, we want you people to start putting up an alternative price structure for your goods and services in gold, in silver, or in both. And we'll provide you with the software and so forth. You tie into the depository. We'll give you all the information that you need to do this, but we want those prices to be there. You don't have to buy and sell with your own customers or clients if both parties don't want to do that. That's up to you. But you have to be capable of doing it. And so the businessmen now have posted these prices. They're capable of selling their goods and services in the alternative currency. The average citizen has his debit card. He's capable of buying and selling within the system if he wants to transfer his money out of the paper money system and put it into the gold and silver depository. And the state now begins to collect taxes in gold and silver. And initially it would be some small amount. In the statute I drafted for New Hampshire, and it was also used in Montana, they chose the tobacco tax as the pump priming mechanism for the reason that it was a relatively small tax, 10, 12% of the total budget, so no one could complain that we're going too far out on a limb. And most of the tobacco tax in both of those states, I believe, was paid by a few corporations who were already paying electronically anyway in paper currency, so it didn't make much difference to them. All they had to do was generate another account in their, you know, in their electronic, in their computer records. And I talked to the treasurer of New Hampshire when we first were laying this in front of the legislature, and he said, oh, there would be no problem for him to do it. He wouldn't even have to hire any new employees. The only thing that would be necessary at some stage would be to get the depository set up. But everything else could be done with the computer systems that he already had. So this was essentially a very efficient operation to get started. And then the state would take that gold and silver that had come in through the initial tax revenue and would offer to pay this out to any of the state creditors first come, first served. And my anticipation was, if you saw increasing crisis, if you will, in the monetary and banking systems, the creditors would be lining up to take that gold and silver out very, very quickly, and of course the gold and silver account would be depleted. Then the treasurer would come back to the legislature and say, oh, we need to expand our tax base because the demand for this alternative currency, at least in our state finances, is increasing. And as the monetary system that we now have goes into crisis, the alternative currency will expand in use, first through the state's collection of taxes and paying out to its creditors, and then within the private economy. Now, on the other hand, if the people in Washington solve the monetary and banking problem, then no one will see any necessity to actually use this system. But it will be there. And that's the important part. It will be there. People will know that it's there. They'll know how to use it. And therefore, if they're confronted with a crisis situation, they can essentially, 60 days, 90 days after that statute is passed, they can completely walk away from the Federal Reserve System, which, of course, cannot be done today. And you certainly cannot do it through barter. That's an impossibility in a society as complicated as this. So that's really what I've been proposing, and simply saying, look, here it is. We can put this system together. It's not very expensive. And initially, it's not going to create any real dislocation in terms of the way people normally operate, except for the people paying the tobacco tax, let's say. And that's not too much of a dislocation. That's a sin tax anyway. No one has much sympathy for those people necessarily. And the rest of society, in terms of getting a debit card, what do you have to do? You fill out some form on the Internet, or you fill out some form and mail it in, the way you do with a credit card application. And on the Internet, it happens immediately. And if you mail it in, it comes in a week later, and there's your debit card. And you're ready to roll. And as far as the businessmen are concerned, the price structure that they set up is going to be facilitated by the state depository. It'll tell them exactly how to do it and what they need to do and how they tie in through their computers to the depository to get all the financial information. And there it is. And a society that has as many people as this one does who know how to use computers, it should certainly not be a problem for people to at least plug into the system, whether they actually use it or not, immediately. So the beauty of it is we don't have to depend upon coinage, because where is coinage controlled? Well, it's controlled the U.S. Treasury, right? That's where coinage comes from, out of the U.S. Mint. States cannot coin money. No state shall coin money, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1. Right? So if we were to use a coinage system, we'd either have to depend upon the Treasury, or potentially on other countries that are generating gold and silver coin. I don't think we want to be dependent in any way, shape, or form on other countries in an emergency situation. And I don't think we can trust the Treasury to want to go along with this after what they did to Bernard von Nothaus. People, I'm sure, remember his case. So the bullion approach to it obviates that problem. And what I would predict would happen under these circumstances is that first state that did it would be, of course, the only political entity in the entire world that had an economically sound currency unit. What would be the effect on the economy of that state, positive or negative? And that's a rhetorical question, because the answer, of course, is positive. Right? Capital tends to flow into those areas in which there is a sound currency as opposed to a rotting vegetable currency. So to the extent that that state could attract capital for industrial development, having a sound currency would be a very important element in bringing it in. And secondly, once one state does it, under the circumstances that we're positing of continuous monetary crises, other states would do it. And it would spread like oil on water. And at some stage down the road, even Congress would have to look at this and say, oh my gosh, we have to come online in this some way, because if we continue to collect taxes in Federal Reserve notes and the Federal Reserve currency wildly depreciates, the real value of these taxes will also go down. And we will discover now that we can no longer fund the federal government in any way through taxation, and we'll have to turn either to borrowing, which we can't do anymore because we've already gone beyond the limit, or we'll have to turn to fiat paper currency, direct inflationary government spending. And that will lead to inflation.
Edwin, can you address the issue of proprietary ownership of the currency? Explain, you know, how that works now and how it would change in the competing system.
Well, now, if you have Federal Reserve notes in your hand, you own them to the extent that, the extent that that's valuable. But if you put Federal Reserve notes into a bank, as soon as those notes cross into, you know, the teller's line there, that money becomes the property of the bank, and you become an unsecured creditor for whatever the amount in the account may be. Now, you might be insured, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, you might not. But the fact of the matter is, you have no money in the bank as a typical depositor. You are a creditor, an unsecured creditor of that institution. And as we see with these banks, being an unsecured creditor of those institutions is a rather risky situation. What we're talking about with the state depository and the alternative currency system is what is known as a bailment system. That gold that is deposited in my name is my gold. I own that. The state depository does not own that. Therefore, I don't run into this risk of suddenly discovering that the state depository goes bankrupt and I become a creditor who can collect nothing. It's my gold. And secondly, I would assume that if this were done properly, that the states would be very, very chary, if you will, of taking any kind of risks with that depository. Certainly, they wouldn't be listening to, you know, the Treasury of the United States telling them what to do with it. But the important thing is that I would be an owner, or you would be the owner, whoever the depositors were. We would be the owners of some portion of that gold. So if I had transferred whatever it was, $1,000 worth of Federal Reserve notes, and I had an ounce of gold in that system, I would have 1 ounce of gold. Now, the system would be set up in such a way that I could withdraw that gold, either in bullion form, if there were enough, the weight of it was enough, or in coin form. Or if I wanted to, the depository would make the appropriate transactions, and I could walk away with Federal Reserve notes or yuan or rubles or whatever else I might require. So you'd have a tremendous amount of flexibility there, too. But the most important thing is it would be owned by the depositors themselves and it would be under the control of the state government, not under the control of Federal Reserve System, not under the control of the financiers and speculators in New York City, and certainly not under the control of the politicians in Washington, D.C.
Something that people have not understood clearly is that when the central bank was given the power to create money, to control the money supply, it actually, in essence, made it more powerful than the government. How does that change in the competing system?
Well, I think it's going to change in the sense that if people walk away from the Federal Reserve system in terms of using the alternative currency in their transactions, then that element of power disappears to the extent that whatever number of people actually walk away. And, of course, the hypothesis here is that the state governments will walk away. The big problem with the Federal Reserve system, I think, is it's going to collapse. That's my worry. It's not that this competition is going to go on for the next 20 years. This competition is going to go on for a relatively short time as the banking system comes down. That's my concern, is dealing with that, what I would say is the catastrophic situation. But let's go back a few years. Let's go back to 1998 or whenever, right? Imagine that you had an alternative currency system of this kind set up then. What would people have been doing as one crisis after another developed over the last 20 years? Would they have started to walk away from the Federal Reserve System? Is the world walking away from the Federal Reserve System? Here you have the five BRIC nations. What are they? Russia, China, South Africa, Indonesia, India, right? Five BRIC nations.
Brazil.
They're talking about an alternative currency. You've got the Chinese and the Russians making bilateral trade agreements in their own currencies. You've got the Iranians certainly wanting to deal in gold because we're trying to freeze them out of the world market. But that's another fear, that the oil producers will walk away from the petrodollar and go to some other currency. So everyone else in the world, apparently, except people in Washington, D.C., and the average American, is realizing that there's a problem that requires the use of an alternative currency. They all haven't settled on this particular approach. And as I say, this one is tailored specifically to our constitutional structure. But they recognize that there's a major problem with the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve note as the world reserve currency, and they're beginning to take the steps to insure themselves against some kind of major breakdown. And that entails selecting some kind of alternative currency, which initially will compete with Federal Reserve notes, and eventually, if you have a catastrophic situation, will simply replace them. And, of course, that's the currency wars problem that Mr. Rickards talks about in his book. Exactly that kind of situation. And so I think he proposes in that book that there be some kind of return to a gold-backed system for the Federal Reserve. Now, I have a major problem with that because we've already done it once and it failed. You can't trust these people to run that kind of a system. The original Federal Reserve Act required a 40% gold backing for Federal Reserve notes and a 35% gold backing for deposits in Federal Reserve regional banks. And that wasn't enough. 40%. That was a fairly large, by any historical standard, reserve. And it wasn't enough. So to think that, having seen what they've done since 1913, or especially since World War II, when the Federal Reserve System was, for all intents and purposes, the world central bank, seeing how they've destroyed this system through incompetence, corruption, or I would say criminality. There's a heck of a lot of criminality here. This isn't just mistakes they've made. Right? Having looked at that, could anyone in his right mind say, number one, we could trust these people, and number two, that a system that has already failed, even if it was only on the basis of incompetence, would work if we staked it again, if we gave it another grub stake of gold backing? I think the answer to that has to be no. And the rest of the world doesn't think so either. I mean, the Germans trying to pull their gold out of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. What's that all about? I'll give you that as an example. They don't even trust the Federal Reserve Bank to hold their physical gold, let alone to manage a world currency system.
Well, you just threw out some percentages on reserve requirements, and I'm thinking, you know, with the existing fractional reserve system, the failures that we've had, but also I'm looking at the Band-Aid. It's not even a good Band-Aid of the Basel III voluntary requirements and how that compares with the percentages that you just mentioned.
Well, voluntary is no good. Yeah, a redeemable currency to be workable at all has to have an absolute legal requirement that the issuer of that currency, when it's presented for redemption, turns over a statutorily fixed amount of gold or silver or, you know, oil, whatever is the backing, whatever is the redemption item. And that's the problem. Every time they've been squeezed in the banking system because their fractional reserve policies have put them in an untenable position, what have they done? They've reneged on the payment. They've reneged on the redemption. That was 1933. Right? Federal Reserve System set up in 1913 for scientific management of the currency. No more inflation, no more depression. 20 years later, the greatest depression the world ever seen. And what did they do? Well, Roosevelt comes in and says, oh, the banks don't have to pay. We're removing the redemption requirement. He kept the redemption requirement internationally because, of course, there were foreign policy implications. But after World War II, when once again this was the only country in the world that hadn't been bombed, if you will, that hadn't had direct physical damage from the war, major country, our industries were in high gear. We had the soundest currency in the world, paper currency in the Federal Reserve System, and we had the largest gold stock in the world, because huge amounts of gold had come into this country, especially during World War II. And what happens? Between 45 and 71, they destroyed the system so that Nixon had to come in, and Connally, Secretary of the Treasury, had to come in 1971 in August and stop international redemption. So we've been through this twice. Three strikes, you're out, right? Well, I mean, this is the third strike in which the system goes down. How many times do you have to see this? I shouldn't say you, but I'm saying, you know, rhetorically. How many times do the American people have to see this before they finally wake up to the fact that this is an unworkable system for all sorts of reasons, and that trying to shore it up is the same as trying to bail out the Titanic with teaspoons? It will not work.
Dr. Vieira, this is Senator Lambert. I got a question for you about that. You mentioned the German request for redemption from the Fed. That has not been honored yet, has it?
No. And the interesting
thing is, just been ignored?
Well, they made a promise. They made a promise that they would pay 30% of the turnover, 30% of the gold, within, I think, was 7 years. Now, what's interesting about this is not a fractional reserve account of some kind that the Germans have. This is German gold. They own the gold, and it was left for safekeeping in the Federal Reserve vaults in New York. So theoretically, there are some bars there that have specific numbers, serial numbered bars, and this is all recorded in accounts, and I would suspect that the Germans have a copy of those accounts. So they go to the Federal Reserve and say, give us our gold, turn over our gold to us. And the Federal Reserve says, oh, no, we can't do that. Not only can't we give you all of it, but we're going to renege on 70% of it, and you're only going to get 30% of it over the next 7 years. Well, now, if I were the German chancellor, not what's-her-name there, Angela Merkel, but if I were the German chancellor, I would call up the embassy and say, look, you get yourselves down there with some 18-wheelers and some forklifts, and you go into the Federal Reserve and you say, we're taking the gold. You have so many bars, we're going to put it on these 18-wheelers, and we have a steamer at Pier 34 in the harbor, and it's going to Bremen. And I would make this an international incident. Now, why didn't they do it? Because they know how shaky the whole banking system is. And worse than that, they probably suspect that that gold is not there, that it's been sold or leased or somehow hypothecated, but physically it's not there. Because if it physically were there, it could be turned over. And theoretically, legally speaking, it can't be used for anything by the Federal Reserve. That gold is not there to be leased or to be sold. It's not an asset of the Federal Reserve. It's an asset of Germany. So what does this tell us? That there's some real chicanery going on, even with respect to that physical gold. Would you trust these people with your physical gold?
So this isn't just a sovereign debt default. What you're describing is exactly the way I understand it. This isn't a sovereign debt default of, you know, U.S. Federal Reserve notes or anything like this. This is physical ownership of German property that we are not returning back to them. This is a default, a sovereign default from the United States government on physical property, is the way I understand it. And I think you're confirming that.
Yeah, I think the word is embezzlement. Right? I mean, I think that would be the term. It would be embezzlement. And you look at that, and I would have thought at that stage that there would have been a huge outcry. But apparently everyone is so afraid, at least at the upper levels of these various governments, everyone is so afraid about the shakiness of the total banking system that they're willing to swallow hard and just accept it. And you're hearing the same thing, interestingly enough, with people who have private accounts around the world, including some of the Swiss banks, of all things, where they are trying to get their gold back from so-called allocated account. An allocated account is where I go into a bank or some kind of depository and I bring the gold in physically. That's my gold. It's recorded in some way, and they are holding it as a trustee for me. It's not their gold. They never gain legal ownership, title, or any kind of legal claim to that gold. It's my gold, allocated account solely for me. And these private parties are going and trying to get their gold out, and the banks are either telling them, well, we can only give you a little bit, or we can only give it to you over a long period of time, or in some cases they're saying you're not going to get it at all, and we'll give you the cash value of it. And then the question becomes, in my mind, where is it? Why would anyone in any bank take that position if the gold were actually there in the box, the strong box? It can only be that it isn't there. And it can't be that it was hypothecated in some way, leased out, because those transactions typically don't involve physical movement of the gold. They're paper transactions. So the gold would still be there, and if those transactions, paper transactions, were illegal because the gold is actually owned by Germany or whoever, well, then you unwind the paper transactions. That's a completely separate legal problem for the people that entered into those transactions illegally. But the gold physically would still be there, and you wouldn't have this problem of failure to deliver or refusal to deliver. So what this tells me is that the gold markets out there are obviously being manipulated, and that when the manipulation finally fails, because at some stage things like the COMEX and so forth, they're not going to be able to pay in the paper price of gold is going to prove to be totally fictitious, that we're going to have a huge upspike in the Federal Reserve price of gold and silver, which actually is a huge decrease in the purchasing power of Federal Reserve notes vis-a-vis gold, and that may be the straw that breaks the camel's back here.
Well, I would like to ask you, I'm sorry, Senator Lambert again, I was wondering if I could ask a question about the alternative gold standard that you presented, because how we implement this is very important. If I can paraphrase, I think the alternative really unpegs from the fiat dollar, from the Federal Reserve note, and goes to a physical gold-backed currency value. And I think I've heard about very similar banks in China, that they're opening several thousand of these across China, and I don't know if they're public or private because China is still a communist country. But I do have a question about the entanglement of a political system, even if it's at the state level, of being sort of the honest broker. I think we've already determined that the Federal Reserve System is not the honest broker. If they're not going to be releasing the value or the actual tangible assets from another sovereign state that it belongs to, how can we trust the state systems or a private system set up by the states to have that kind of honesty here in the United States?
Well, I start off from the problem of getting a system going that won't be subject to immediate suppression by Washington. And obviously private parties could set up this kind of a system, but then they're subject to all sorts of currency regulations, money broker regulations. FinCEN comes into this, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network comes into this to look at money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. So Washington, D.C. can step in, intervene, and make life very, very difficult for a private entity attempting to do this, whereas we have a constitutional power in the state to do it. So it's really a question initially of, can we get this thing off the ground at all? Secondly, if I were to do this ultimately the right way, who would I put in control of the state depository? The statutes that created the alternative currency would also revitalize the state militia, and it would be the people themselves in the state militia that would control the state depository. And if you can't trust the people themselves in the state depository to control their own gold and silver, then I don't know who the heck you can trust. I certainly wouldn't, in the long run, I wouldn't trust any politician, obviously. But whenever I mention the word militia, people tighten up their, industrial strength depends, if you know what I mean. It scares the heck out of the average state legislator. But, you know, when you're talking about, well, can we trust the state government as opposed to, we can't trust Congress, we can't trust the Federal Reserve, we can't do this through private parties, we certainly don't want to deal with a Chinese bank, because you have foreign policy implications there. Here we have the state as the only alternative. And sometimes it takes a crooked stick to beat a mad dog, if you know what I mean. Sometimes you have to take a chance. Now, weigh a risk against a certainty. The certainty is the system we have now is going into some kind of catastrophic freefall. What's the alternative? Well, this one at least we could set up. And to a certain extent, we have to depend upon the honesty, dependability, competence, at least initially, of the state officials. But I think if it were done in the most stringent manner, that would be under control too. But the alternative being total chaos, you know, I would be willing to take the risk, especially because if you didn't have the chaos, it doesn't cost anything to have this alternative. It's not as if we're putting powers into the hands of these state officials that they're going to run amok with and abuse. If you don't have the currency collapse, the alternative currency system is probably not going to be used to any extent more than the very small amount of taxes that would be in the pump priming mechanism.
Well, it seems like you mentioned the basis of the sound money argument, and it looks like we're going full circle back to Roger Sherman's principles of Article 1, Section 10, which he linked back to a moral and ethical basis for our currency. I mean, that was the basis of it. It was a biblical thing. We shouldn't have false weights and measures, and we shouldn't cheat our neighbors. And sure. Yet our current system seems to be totally dependent upon that. I mean, you mentioned the constitutionality of doing this. I think that's very true. But when our system is over-leveraged, set up by laws like Dodd-Frank, and they brought policies into play that will oppose sound money to the very death because it would interfere with the corruption that's currently in the system. I don't know if we can even assume a legal basis for doing this, that a legal basis would, like you did correctly say, that the federal government's going to be pushing back on this. I was kind of interested in your use of the word insurance a while ago, because now we, you know, for the first time in American history under Obamacare, the government can force you to make a contract for insurance without your permission, totally, in my opinion, against all principles of the Constitution. And yet, you know, they're saying, well, this is a form of taxation, so they can do it. But if you can do that, then the government can come in and force another alternative form of insurance on us as well, or force insurance of fiat currency, which again has no basis in sound money. So I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, at some point we come back to the problem: are checks and balances? Right. If there's no pushback, they'll do everything they want to do and more. That's been the problem all along. They've been ratcheting up this system because no one has ever pushed back in all of these steps. And now we've gotten to the stage where essentially we're in a desperate situation. So I don't know what the alternative is other than to shrug your shoulders and say, well, we're doomed. You know, let's all go have another drink and watch the Super Bowl again, or replays of, Oprah or something, I Love Lucy, whatever it is your taste in late night television entertainment.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, food stamps now, for instance, the SNAP program, they call it, is almost like a currency. You can now get a card. There's no physical stamps, anything else, based totally upon money that we don't have. In some cases, we're borrowing from overseas sources. And you can do anything with these cards. You can go to the ATMs. You can do anything. The chance for corruption is just infinite in some of these programs.
So, you know, I think maybe, you know, you're looking at a focus on the states. There needs to be some sort of motivator for, you know, moving out or moving back to some sort of sound currency. And I think maybe the most current manipulations of gold here in the last several months, you know, I think they've been driving the price down, you know, manipulating the markets, selling short and so forth on gold in the with not just the Federal Reserve, but all the central banks. And, you know, the markets that are actually buying gold in China and India are saying, great, we'll take the physical gold. Thank you very much. We're not going to be worried about the short-term cost of your EFTs. We're going to take the physical gold, sit on it, and, you know, 5-10 years from now, they may be making a hard gold currency standard in those countries, and we will suddenly wake up and find that there is no international trade because we don't have anything to trade with.
Yeah, that's the problem. We'll wake up, and we'll be in the septic tank. And what I'm trying to point out to people is the septic tank is only a couple of steps away. You really want to turn aside from that path. This is what I find incredible. You hear all of these arguments, and you see things going on in the rest of the world on the part of people who don't kowtow to Washington, D.C., or the Federal Reserve, or New York City. And it's as obvious as the nose in front of your face what the significance of these moves is. And it may be 5 years, it may be 10 years. I don't think it'll be as long as 10 years, but it's coming. And yet the people in this country, and I can understand why in New York and D.C. they don't want to face this because they have a nice little racket of their own they don't want to give up. But why the people in the states, especially the state legislatures, who will be held accountable for this? Thank you very much. You know, I've gone around and talked to a number of state legislators, and I look at my view is, once you've been told this, if it happens and you haven't taken action, you are responsible. Because we know the people in Congress aren't going to do it. We know the Federal Reserve's not going to do it. We know the speculators in New York are not going to do it. You people in the state legislatures can do it. And if this has been made manifest to you, which it has, because it's notorious, it's all over the bloody internet. You don't have to talk to me on the radio to get this kind of information. And you don't act, when the people start lighting up those torches and sharpening their pitchforks, guess who they're going to come after? And it won't be me.
Yeah, I wish we'd...
Someone is going to be held responsible for this.
Yeah, I wish they'd start sharpening their pitchforks now because, frankly, this is not... we don't hear much about this in the Capitol. There is not a... I guess we got to have more citizen education about what's happening and put some pressure on other legislators. You know, we're having a huge debate in Colorado right now just over the Second Amendment. And
absolutely.
You know, I'm sure you know, I think we started the program here with Terry saying we already have two states, for the first time in Colorado history, 150 years, whatever it is, first time in Colorado history that we've recalled a legislator. And now we have two of them that they've had sufficient signatures to actually go ahead with a recall. They're fighting it, of course. But people are pretty darn mad that of this bait-and-switch type of tactic when, you know, they simply will not listen to the will of the people. That's a very visceral issue for people, maybe because they can tangibly see their guns, they can see their magazines, they can know that the state is coming after them. But what about their money? I mean, all we have in terms of money is some paper in the pocket that has no value. And I don't know if this is real to people, that the money, I mean, left. I remember, you know, my grandmother and grandfather would get a half dollar. It was actually a half dollar. It actually had silver in it when they earned it. And now it's worth, you know, that silver dollar is, of course, worth what it was originally intended for, but now 50 cents is worth nothing. I mean, it's worth 2 cents, you know, compared to what it was in their generation. So we don't have even the right with our own wages, our own earnings, to have a currency to store what we worked for. And, you know, this should be, like you say, a universal outrage on the part of our citizens, but most of them just don't see it.
Well, the comparison between the gun issue and the money issue is I think that on the gun issue, people recognize that that has something to do with self-protection, self-preservation. It might be from the adventitious criminal, or it might be from the tyrant, depending on how sophisticated you are in your knowledge of the Second Amendment. But it doesn't take a very acute mind to grasp that connection, especially in light of American history. Money is a rather arcane subject to the average person. And that's why these bankers and manipulators have gotten away with what they've gotten away with, because they've been able to sell a bill of goods to the average Joe, and they haven't had to respond to real criticisms of what they're doing, certainly not from the grassroots level. And that's one of the reasons that I've been trying to promote as a first step in this, the Legislative Study Commission. Here in Virginia, they set them up all the time, but we haven't been able to get one. It's not something that's really an odd arrangement. Because I would see that as a platform not only for educating the legislators, because at least here in Virginia you have legislators on that kind of a commission, and then that information would be produced in a report of some kind and would get back to everybody else in the legislature, but because it would be done publicly with open testimony and presentation of evidence from experts and so on, it would be an educational process for the general public as well. And if it were done with a certain sophistication in publicity, of course, I don't think even the major local media could black it out, especially given the nature of the problem once that starts to be laid on the table. Right? And at that point, people don't have to understand all of the intricacies of banking and money. They only have to come back to this point. Do I have a sound currency unit that is not going to be depreciating like a rotting cabbage? And do I actually own this and control it, or is it owned and controlled and manipulated from Washington and New York or London or wherever? International bankers congregate, Basel probably in Switzerland, right? Bank of International Settlements. And that distinction, I think, is one that the average person can certainly grasp. The gold coin in his hand, as it were, versus this phantom of electronic currency that everyone can see is failing. But you've got to get people, in a sense, worked up along the right line. And the right line has to be, yes, we have this problem. Yes, it can't be solved by tinkering with the present system. And we have this alternative. And you folks can have the advantage of this alternative if you will simply get off your rear ends, get on your hind legs, and make those telephone calls, send in those emails, go down to the state capitol, do whatever it is you need to do to exert grassroots lobbying pressure on your legislator. Ultimately, with the point being made that now that this has become public, he's responsible. He can't slough this off anymore on the Federal Reserve. He can't slough this off anymore on the people in New York. He can't slough this off on Mr. Obama. It's now a state issue because the state can actually do something about it. And then the question will be, well, why aren't you doing it?
Well,
I don't think they have an answer to that. I don't think there is a rational answer as to why this shouldn't be done, or at least it shouldn't be investigated.
We had an interesting yes.
I'll let you continue in a minute. I did promise to get back to Representative Heichel with his question, but I also want to mention to you, Senator, that I believe that it would be – I believe the people are already in place. If we put together just a little bit of coordinated effort between Douglas County and El Paso County, I believe that we could structure an education program, and I believe that the people are already in place to springboard that and let it grow throughout the state from there. We could structure the curriculum and start the program and then invite others to participate in it, but I don't want to go there right now. We've only got about 42 minutes left in this show, and I'm telling you, an hour and 20 minutes went by in a big hurry. Representative Heichel, do you have a question at this point? Are you muted on your end? Well, he's still on the board, and I've got an open mic on him. So if you have a question, please jump in with it and let us know that you're there, because we're not hearing you. We do have some other people with their hands raised. Can we have some other questions come in at this point? Is it okay to shift a little bit?
That's great for me. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah,
why not?
Absolutely.
Stephen Hance, you have an open mic.
Okay.
I've been listening intently here, and my question is really the same now as it was when the concept was first presented to me some time ago, and that is, and you've touched on it, which is, of course, Article 1, Section 10, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin for paying debts. And you have danced around it or jumped over it by saying that the states can create this new system themselves by virtue of that fact, yet it says very clearly that the states cannot make money, create money. And yet you're suggesting that that's exactly what they should do. And not only that, you're suggesting that that they make this money in the form of an electronic currency that is, in my mind, more complicated and convoluted than what we already have. But the real issue for me is that I see this whole problem as one of a constitutional limitation. First of all, the states have no authority to do anything other than abide by the limitation of making nothing but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And they're also further limited by the fact that they are forbidden to make money, to create money, to coin money. That is strictly in the purview of the federal government. Now, the fact that the federal government has shirked its responsibility in that process of giving the power, the illegal and unconstitutional power, to the Federal Reserve Bank is another issue, but they're all issues of authority. They're all issues of government exceeding the authority given to it by the constitutions. And to my mind, the only appropriate, although you know your proposals may make absolute mathematical sense and be very logical, I do not see how it is possible to achieve anything similar to what you're talking about legally, lawfully, constitutionally. You have to change the Constitution in order to do what you're suggesting, and I don't think that will happen, number one. Number two, I don't believe it's necessary for it to happen if we put the boards of review in place to hold the legislators, the executive branch, all of them accountable for their oath of office, which means that they are all subject to the limitations of their authority and their power by what's actually written in the Constitution. These problems can be made to go away virtually overnight if we simply hold them accountable, or as Thomas Jefferson said, bind them down by the chains of the Constitution. The Constitution has adequate chains to bind the rascals down. But in my mind, what you're suggesting not only requires a great deal of education that I don't see happening in the 10 years that you think we might have. It's a big job, whereas holding them accountable to what's actually written is a fairly pedestrian venture. I don't guess I really put a question there, Terry, but I guess my question would be, how do you respond to that?
Well, we start from the top. You go to Article 1, Section 10, no state shall coin money. We're not asking states to coin money. No state shall emit bills of credit. We're certainly not asking the states to emit bills of credit. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin, a tender in payment of debts. That's what's being proposed.
Well,
let's say this. The state adopts, Utah passed a statute not too long ago, saying that in Utah, United States gold and silver coin shall be legal tender in payment of debts. Do they create money? Do they violate Article 1, Section 10 doing that?
Absolutely not, right?
They said that can be used in payment of debts. Now, the bullion question as opposed to coinage was already settled by the Supreme Court. Bronson versus Rhodes, Butler versus Horwitz, a number of cases that decided this after the Civil War when you had the gold coin, silver coin versus the greenbacks. So that's all settled as bullion and coin being essentially fungible for constitutional purposes. So the only question that arises here is, and so you're not really, I'm not really creating, asking them to create money. I'm asking them to create a mechanism whereby people can use for the purposes of exchange something that the Constitution has already recognized as money. Oh, and by the way, the Supreme Court recognized as money within the purview of the states twice. I mentioned that earlier, Lane County case and the Hagar case.
Yeah, you did.
They included coinage and bullion within the power of the states to use. The depository system is really no different in a sense than a state bank. And state banks have been upheld by the Supreme Court since the 1830s, again and again and again. All right. There's a problem when they start issuing paper currency. But we're not talking about them issuing paper currency. We're talking about them being a depository bank where they're simply transferring on the books ownership interest in currency that somebody else has had. Somebody else has the gold and silver. And when you think about the complications of this, there really is no complication. This is an electronic recording accounting system. There's some gold sitting there, and there's an electronic recording, and of course there'd be a paper backup, that says who owns how much in account number such and such. And then if that particular individual wants to transfer some of that gold to some other account holder, he gives an order to the depository, and the depository does that on the books.
Right. I understand.
Okay. The technical part of this is pretty simple as opposed
right,
to being
what
too complicated.
What I don't understand is, number one, the Supreme Court cases that you referenced, I think you said Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
I have never studied the cases, so I can't speak intelligently about them, but I cannot accept or believe that the decision of a handful of jurists can literally transform the words that are clearly written in the Constitution. There is a huge difference between bullion and coin, and it's clearly states, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt.
Well, then we'll make you happy and have this system run entirely on coinage.
It has nothing to do with making me happy.
I'm just saying that, you know, this comes up as some kind of a problem, it can be run entirely on coinage because you can do this absolutely the same thing with coinage.
It has absolutely nothing to do
uh-huh.
with making me happy. It has to do with obeying what is strictly written in the Constitution. You can offer your interpretation.
Yeah, but you see, hang on a second. The concept of a tender is a forced payment. If the state simply sets up a mechanism whereby people voluntarily can exchange anything, oyster shells for that matter, we don't have a problem with a tender, making a tender. Making a tender is a statute that says you have to use something in payment of debts as the unit of currency. All right? This system is not going to require, as I said earlier, it's not going to require anyone to make these transactions other than in the payment of taxes, and taxes have been ruled from the beginning not to be debts unless they've been reduced to judgment. And if the state is paying out voluntarily to its creditors, it's not forcing a tender on anyone. It's saying, we're offering to pay this if you want it. If the treasurer can also offer Federal Reserve notes for those creditors who want that. So there's no tender aspect involved in this. That's one of the beauties of it. We remove the whole system, essentially, from any kind of forced transaction. What eventually forces the transactions is economic reality. The intelligent person is not going to take the depreciating currency. He's going to ask for the currency that maintains its purchasing power. And the state is simply going to say, oh, we have this mechanism whereby you folks can make these transfers. And the state is going to guarantee that they're done in an efficient and honest manner. In the same way that if we had a state bank, we could do the same thing.
Yeah, you could, but that's not the point. The point is it's unconstitutional.
What's unconstitutional?
You're creating something that you have no authority to do.
I haven't created anything.
If you, not you personally, but if everyone was compelled in the government structures to obey what's written in the Constitution, we wouldn't have these problems.
Okay, well, let's go to that. Let's go to that and see what the alternative is. But let's go to that and see what the alternative is. These boards of review. And the question I ask you is, who enforces whatever determinations they come to? You set up a group of people, and let's assume that these people are capable of gaining all sorts of information about political corruption, political incompetence, whatever it is, that the public officials are violating their oaths of office with respect to A, B, C, D, whatever the list of derelictions may be. And you get this from whistleblowers, you get it from whatever, because, of course, you have no subpoena power, you have no ability to force people to testify, you have no ability to force documents to be turned over, but you get this information. And now you publicize it. And I say...
Excuse me.
And I say, how do you enforce that?
First of all, a major component of the structure of the boards of review is subpoena power. And the enforcement is, as you suggested earlier, militia, the people themselves.
Oh, well, then why don't you just do this through the militia? Why do you need
a
separate board of review?
With the militia?
Excuse me?
Why don't you just do your deal with the militia?
I would. That's what I said earlier. If I were doing this to completion, that's what I would do. But you have a great difficulty when you come to state legislators and you start talking about revitalizing the militia. They become very, very nervous.
No doubt.
All right? So if you're talking about a board of review that was part of a militia structure, then I would say, well, that's fine. In fact, I have a long section in the Sword and Sovereignty that deals with exactly this question, because it ties into the question of exemptions from the militia. You know, historically, the militia granted exemptions to people in public office and people in certain private occupations, because it was believed that when they were performing those functions for the public or in these occupations, that function was so important that they shouldn't have to come to the regular militia musters and perform certain routine duties. Although most of those people, if there were what they called an alarm, an emergency situation, they were called up anyway. But those exemptions were based upon the principle that individuals, let's say public officials, were performing this important function properly. And therefore it would follow that the militia would have a right of supervision of those exempted individuals to be sure that they were in fact performing the functions for which the exemptions were granted. And therefore within each militia unit to which those exempted people would formally belong, those people would be subject to some kind of investigatory power of militia group, what you're calling, I suppose, a board of review, all right, except it would be within the militia. And the militia, of course, would have some kind of oversight authority with respect to those people. So you have an enforcement mechanism that would be built in.
You don't get it.
Excuse me?
You don't get it.
What don't I get?
Who's muted and unmuted? Is this thing
I'm sorry,
working?
I was trying to activate a different one. I hit the wrong one.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, the People's Board of Review has nothing intrinsically to do with the militia.
Right.
It's grassroots, the people themselves coming forward and creating a structure to hold the public servants accountable.
Okay.
The militia would be called on as deputies of the court or the whatever structure the people deem necessary for their own jurisdiction. I've created a sample charter to suggest how I would go about doing it, but I'm not suggesting that everybody has to do anything my way. But the point is, your understanding of what I'm talking about is not clear.
Well, you're going to have to call them up.
The people themselves bringing forth their own authority to hold the public.
That's what I said.
Excuse me?
I was trying to get the mic squared away, and somebody got a live mic that had background noise, so I muted them back off. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. The point is that the constitutions are the organic law that all of these public servants are bound by. The chains that Thomas Jefferson referenced are in the Constitution. We just need to take them and bind the rascals down with them. And that cannot be accomplished through legislation because all of the legislatures are bought and sold. It can't be accomplished in the courts because the courts are not judicial in nature, and they are bought and sold. You can't accomplish the task that is before us with anything other than a structure similar to what I've presented as a People's Board of Review. Quo warranto. Give them, bring forward, how do you answer to the charge that you don't have any authority to do what you're doing? And when it's proven that they don't, they're out of office.
Well, that's what I don't understand. You set up this board of review that has no legislative mandate. There's no statute that creates it. It's
exactly.
A group of people that have gotten together. They perform some investigatory function on their own. They determine that Representative Doakes is acting outside of his authority. Perhaps they contact him and ask him to explain himself and give him a chance to come up with an excuse. And either he doesn't do that or he tells them to go whistle. And then what happens?
What happens is the Board of Review rules against him.
Okay.
His superiors, if there are any, depending on the office that's being charged or accused of wrongdoing or failing to live up to the mandate of his oath of office, his superiors are given 40 days to correct the problem or prove that it doesn't exist.
Okay.
When they do so, then it becomes the job of the enforcement arm of the Board of Review, and that would be the sheriff or whoever the appropriate executive officer might be in the case at hand. And if it falls to the people themselves, the militia, then they're deputized and sent out to do the job.
And how is the sheriff connected to the sheriff? Sheriff is a statutory or constitutional officer in the states.
That's
He's
correct.
Not part of this board of. I mean, why is the sheriff? This is my question. I'm just wondering, why is the sheriff going to respond to anything that the board of review tells him?
Well, for one thing, it's his job. He works for the people.
Gentlemen, can I jump in for a second, please?
Yeah, please.
There's no question that there's a lot of groundwork that has to be done in restoring the well-regulated state militia. And I do see that there's some way to have the boards of review situation work in conjunction with that, and also in building relationships with the local sheriff and other local officials. The problem that we've got here, it comes back to what I was saying earlier about when you allow the banks to create the money and control the money supply, that facilitates a banking taxing vortex that allows the centralization of power, because they are stealing the production of the people. In the absence of sound money, they're able to steal the production of the people through the present system. It is theft that's been going on. This allowance of an inflation with paper money is a form of taxation. It is a form of theft. People who are not working for the production are taking the production of the people, and they are acquiring, they are buying through bribery, through blackmail, through all sorts of means. They're taking the money that they're stealing, and they're turning around, and they buy the media, they buy the movie studios, they buy the newspapers, they buy the radio stations, and they control the information flow. And then if they can't control the political figures, they will take them out, and they have. So there will be no redress of grievances. There will be no enforcement by militia or by a board of review until we break that banking taxing vortex and decentralize that power. And sound money is the only way that I've seen that will effectively facilitate that.
Right.
Now, Edwin, I want to give you the floor for a minute and let you respond to that comment.
Well, I think we've gone beyond that point. All right. I don't think you can get control of this monetary system until you can give the people an alternative. I don't think you can give them an alternative unless you have them actually gain control of their state governments and be able to defend themselves against the counterattack that's going to come out of Washington, New York, and London. And that's going to have to be done ultimately by the revitalization of the militia, the 13 most important words in the Constitution. Because the militia actually have constitutional status of a permanent nature and constitutional authority of a permanent nature, unlike all of these other kind of ad hoc inventions that people come up with. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. My experience is, over the years, when people start reinventing the wheel usually comes up square. The militia in the Constitution already have the ability to perform these functions that we're talking about tonight, and to provide protection in the performance of those functions, which cannot be done otherwise. And I give you the example of Bernard von Nothaus. Here was this fellow that went out with the Liberty Dollar. I'm sure everyone is familiar with that. And what was he trying to do? To create a private alternative to Federal Reserve notes, which people would use entirely voluntarily. You choose or not to choose to use it. And I don't know exactly how successful he was. I think maybe his propaganda was a little more fulsome than the actual amount of usage of this. But it was sufficiently successful that the Treasury and the Mint and then the Department of Justice came down on him and put him through a show trial in North Carolina. And I think he's still up on appeal. He was convicted in that case. All right. And there was the demonstration of the individual acting entirely, as far as I could see, entirely within the law and what he was doing, had the full force of the Washington government brought to bear on him and no possible protection. Because, of course, they took his gold and silver from his vaults, and he was left essentially penniless with a public defender in the federal court case. So we're trying to approach this matter from the private side without having the people properly organized with constitutional authority. And the only way to do that is through, as far as I can tell, through the militia structure. It's not going to succeed. And the beauty of doing it that way, of course, is that it ties in directly with the federal system. These aren't some subsets or sub-entities. They're state institutions, the militia. So now you bring to bear all of the constitutional reserve powers, 10th Amendment, so forth and so on, none of which really is going to be applicable directly to private organizations that are set up and make claims about authority that they simply do not have.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
My Skype connection was going in and out. We've got someone who would like to make a question or comment. If it's all right, I'd like to get him in here before the show's gone. Steve, area code 309, you have an open mic.
Okay, all right, I appreciate it. I kind of got in on this a little bit late, but I got into the part where the gentleman was talking about not reinventing the wheel and using what we got on this money issue and doing it electronically. Am I correct on what he was talking about as you know, going back to the gold, silver, bullion, or whatever it was, whatever they choose, but he wants to do it electronically. Is that his intention?
Well, the transfers,
right,
and the accounting are done electronically simply because that's the way people now find the most efficient for making monetary transactions.
Here's my objection to that. That is just giving somebody the ability to monitor what I'm doing, and that's exactly what they are doing now with the Federal Reserve. When you write checks or whatever, your debit cards or whatever, they have the ability to set and monitor what your transactions are, to who and when and where. And that would be my objection to be going through something that would be done electronically. Right now, I've got a complaint with my senator over, I had my daughter passed away last year, and our privacy up at the hospital was violated because people are allowed to monitor what's going on. And I talked to my bankers and stuff, and they tell me the Federal Reserve knows what we're doing, when we do it, and whatever. And going back to the gold and silver, we eliminate that because I don't want somebody knowing what I'm buying, when I buy it, who I buy it from. I would like my privacy back that we, over the what you want to call what we're doing today, my privacy has been totally violated. So,
well, the alternative system wouldn't prevent you. The alternative system would not prevent you and anyone that you wanted to deal with in dealing in actual physical gold or silver or, for that matter, anything else without having any kind of electronic control over it.
Like the monitoring of it.
Yeah, the monitoring. I mean, nothing would stop people from operating outside of that system. And, of course, one would hope that the people in the state would have sufficient control over their own government so that that government would not be, in a sense, monitoring those transactions or sending them to the Federal Reserve or what have you. I mean, we have a huge problem with intelligence agencies that are now coming out, the NSA and CIA and so forth and so on. This is an endemic problem, and that has to be stopped quite clearly. But in an alternative currency system, at least the one that I have in view, an individual who wanted to operate essentially offline and not have his transactions recorded in some way, would certainly be free to do so.
I would have to have a guarantee of that before I'm convinced of it.
Well, the guarantee is that he'd be doing it.
How are you going to
use
it offline?
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't know what kind of guarantee you'd give to
somebody.
One at a time,
please.
Can't you do that today? Let me just ask that question. Can't you do that today without telling me any secrets, right? You and I can make gold and silver transactions between ourselves with no monitoring whatsoever, unless we want to, you know, report this for tax purposes, right?
Okay.
We can do that right now, even under this terrible system that we have.
Okay, so why are you proposing it be done electronically?
Well, because
most
people's transactions are not going to be done face-to-face and hand-to-hand. The state's transactions are not going to be done that way. The state's not going to collect taxes from people in bags of gold and silver coin.
Well, that's what we need to get back to, I guess.
Oh,
may
okay.
May I jump in for a second? This system that Edwin has proposed, first of all, has a division of services so that different people own different pieces of this. The electronic transfer would be outsourced to an independent group that would neither own the bank nor own the gold and silver. They would be outsourced with that so that it would be an independent group, not the government, that can do that. And those systems are already in place and ready to go. It's like you said earlier, off the shelf. The key to this is that by the state passing this legislation and making gold and silver legal tender within the state and forcing it into circulation by collecting taxes, which has to happen, that's how the insurance policy gets put in place so that when the Federal Reserve System goes down and all of the fiat currency systems, whether it's state bank or federal bank, goes down, then the system is in place to maintain the commerce ongoing in that state so that you do not crash your economy along with the fiat.
And yeah, Terry, you said an important thing there, state bank. We have a lot of people in this country talking about state banks, State Bank of North Dakota as the example that's given. And what I say to those people is, even if the state bank is run in a very prudent way with honest individuals, so forth and so on, at the present time, its currency unit is the Federal Reserve note. So if you want to turn even to a state banking system, you'd better be able to have that state banking system using a sound currency unit, because it will fail along with the Federal Reserve system if they're both using the same unit.
How many times have I heard you say, Edwin Vieira, that you will have nothing to do with any banking system that is based on paper currency? And how many times have you said it's not who owns the bank, but who owns the currency? And
that's
those
right.
Are the key,
that's right.
Those are the key differences here, the key differences.
That's right.
But we have to have a wall of protection at the state level to prevent, like you said, Barnard von Nothaus's situation. A lot of people don't realize that he's being subjected to political prisoner along with a lot of other people out there,
mm-hmm.
because he was competing. And we have to have a wall of protection at the state level to prevent the federal tyrants from coming in and crucifying the individual within the state. And the only way that that's going to happen is if the state steps into that position. And this competing system does that. It accomplishes that so that they cannot come in, because gold and silver then becomes legal tender, so you're not breaking the law and the feds cannot come in. Then the sheriffs can step in and do their job to protect the individual citizens within their counties against the federal tyranny. But they can't stop them right now effectively. But putting the state in as a wall between them, that gets accomplished. But you've got to have the system in place as the insurance policy, and you've got to have a way to economically, on an economic scale, force the gold and silver into circulation where the merchants are able to take it, pay it into the state. The state offers it back out to the contractors. That does not prevent private transfers from happening without electronic transfer. That system is set up so that you can use that as a tool to force it through the circulation, but it does not stop your private transfer off record.
No, absolutely not.
You can have the foreign.
That's absolutely true. That any of these proposals assume that people will be able on their own to deal in gold, silver, or any other thing that they want as currency in their own private transactions without necessarily participating in this system. I simply think that the way things actually run, the vast majority of people will use this kind of a system. And the point you made about going back to Bernard von Nothaus, we cannot stand alone as individuals or small private groups in this fight. Bernard von Nothaus proved that. He was an individual because he had a lot of people that were supporting him, but when push came to shove, he had no protective mechanism. He had no barrier between himself and the Department of Justice, the Department of Treasury, and the U.S. Mint, and he was basically steamrolled, and I would agree with you that, to a very large extent, it's correct to call him some kind of political prisoner, political trial that was held, simply because he was challenging the monopoly of the Federal Reserve System. And that's what will happen to any individual.
Isn't it interesting that what he was doing was anything but counterfeit? He was actually producing a certified silver coin, not claiming it as a currency, but using it as a barter, rare commodity barter. And it's the counterfeiters that have convicted him.
That's right.
The counterfeiters
Nobody ever
are
claimed,
the central bank.
That's right. Nobody ever claimed that he was putting out silver or gold coins that had false weights and measures. Everything about his system was completely above board and corrected with respect to that. But that didn't matter. And so I think he's a good example of the problem that if these intermediate protective levels, and of course the state is the major one, are not brought to bear on this problem, then anyone who attempts to circumvent or attack or whatever the Federal Reserve monopoly in terms of alternative currency is simply going to find himself steamrolled. And in Bernard von Nothaus's case, he was financially destroyed, and he was convicted of a crime. The worst of all possible worlds.
Senator Lambert, you've been quiet for a long time, and Red Beckman's been quiet for 2 hours. That's amazing. I just wanted to let you know that there's about 2.5 minutes left here. We're about out of time. I really want to thank everybody for this call tonight, and I think the spirited debate is needed. You know, some people see this as being, why are we fighting, or why are we arguing? Well, sometimes you got to do that. Sometimes you got to butt heads, for especially people in the freedom movement. They don't accept things right off. That, you know, you sometimes we've got thick skulls, all of us do. And we've got to be able to deal with this and be able to communicate in this way. And we're down to 90 seconds. Senator Lambert, do you have a final word?
Yes, thank you on that. And I don't know if we have fixed goals or variable goals. I think we're working toward the same goal, and that's to, you know, restore an economic system that we could actually trust. And, there are going to be differences of opinion about how we can get there and what's practical. But I would like to thank Dr. Vieira for presenting some very stimulating things, and I'm looking forward to some more discussion in the Colorado legislature about some of these principles. And Terry, I'll be looking forward to your call, and we'll try to set something up next session.
Well, I believe we've got to do another one of these shows because I think we've just scratched the surface. Dr. Vieira, you have 30 seconds to close us out.
Well, I think we've certainly proven the point tonight that this is a important and controversial issue even among ourselves, but the point of agreement that's come to my mind at least is we know something has to be done and we know we have to do it because nobody else will. And the next step is
amen to that.
Roll up our sleeves and get out there and start pitching.
Good night, everyone. We are out of time. Thank you so
much.
Terry. This has been a great show. I really enjoyed this, and we'll see everyone next week on Walls in Our Minds.
Thanks, Terry.